time I really wanted to keep going. The sun was shining. I was clean and refreshed. There was ample food in our packs. I had spoken to my wife by phone and knew that all was well. Above all, I was starting to feel fit. I was sure I had lost nearly 10 pounds already. I was ready to go. Katz, too, was aglow with cleanness and looking chipper. We packed our purchases on the porch and realized, together in the same instant, with joy and amazement, that Mary Ellen was no longer part of our retinue. I put my head in the door and asked if they had seen her.
"Oh, I think she left about an hour ago," Peggy said.
Things were getting better and better. It was after 4 o'clock by the time we set off again. Justin had said there was a natural meadow ideal for camping about an hour's walk farther on. The trail was warmly inviting in late afternoon sunlight. There were long shadows from the trees and expansive views across a river valley to stout, charcoal-colored mountains, and the meadow was indeed a perfect place to camp. We pitched our tents and had the sandwiches, chips, and soft drinks we had bought for dinner. Then, with as much pride as if I had baked them myself, I brought out a little surprise. 2 packets of Hostess cupcakes. Katz's face lit up like the birthday boy in a Norman Rockwell painting.
"Oh, wow!"
"They didn't have any Little Debbies," I apologized.
"Hey,"
he said.
"Hey!"
He was lost for greater eloquence. Katz loved cakes. We ate 3 of the cupcakes between us and left the last one on the log, where we could admire it, for later. We were lying there, propped against logs, burping, smoking, feeling rested and content, talking for once. In short, acting much as I had envisioned it in my more optimistic moments back home, when Katz let out a low groan. I followed his gaze to find Mary Ellen striding briskly down the trail towards us from the wrong direction.
"I wondered where you guys had got to," she scolded. "You know, you are, like, really slow. We could have done another 4 miles by now, easy. I can see I'm going to have to keep my eyes on you from now. Say, is that a Hostess cupcake?"
Before I could speak or Katz could seize a log with which to smite her dead, she said,
"Well, I don't mind if I do,"
and ate it in 2 bites. It would be some days before Katz smiled again. Chapter 5
"So what's your star sign?" said Mary Ellen.
"Cunnilingus," Katz answered, and looked profoundly unhappy. She looked at him.
"I don't know that one."
She made an I'll-be-darned frown and said,
"I thought I knew them all. Mine's Libra."
She turned to me.
"What's yours?"
"I don't know." I tried to think of something. "Necrophilia?"
"I don't know with that one either. Say, are you guys putting me on?"
"Yeah." It was 2 nights later. We were camped at a lofty spot called Indian Grave Gap, between 2 brooding summits, the one tiring to recollect, the other dispiriting to behold. We had hiked 22 miles in 2 days, a highly respectable distance for us, but a distinct listlessness and sense of anticlimax, a kind of mid-mountain lassitude, had set in. We spent our days doing precisely what we had done on previous days, and would continue to do on future days, over the same sorts of hills, along the same wandering track, through the same endless woods. The trees were so thick that we hardly ever got views, and when we did get views, it was of infinite hills covered in more trees. I was discouraged to note that I was grubby again already, and barking for white bread. And then, of course, there was the constant, prattling, awesomely brainless presence of Mary Ellen.
"When's your birthday?"
she said to me. "December 8th.
"That's Virgo."
"No, actually it's Sagittarius."
"Whatever."
And then abruptly,
"Geez, you guys stink."
"Well, we've been walking."
"Me, I don't sweat. Never have. Don't dream either."
"Everybody dreams," Kat said.
"Well, I don't."
"Except people of extremely low intelligence. It's a scientific fact." Mary Ellen regarded him expressionlessly for a moment, then said abruptly, to neither of us in particular,
"Do you ever have that dream when you're, like, at school, and you look down, and, like, you haven't got any clothes on?"
She shuddered.
"I hate that one."
I thought you didn't dream, said Katz. She stared at him for a very long moment, as if trying to remember where she had encountered him before.
And falling? She went on, unperturbed. I hate that one, too. Like when you fall into a hole and just fall and fall.
She gave a brief shiver, and then noisily unblocked her ears. Katz watched her with idle interest. I know a guy who did that once, he said, and one of his eyes popped out. She looked at him, doubtfully. It rolled right across the living room floor, and his dog ate it. Isn't that right, Bryson? I nodded.
You're making that up.
I'm not. It rolled right across the floor, and before anybody could do anything, the dog gobbled it down in one bite. I confirmed it for her with another nod. She considered this for a minute.
So, what did your friend do about his eye hole? Did he have to get a glass eye or something?
Well, he wanted to. But his family was kind of poor, you know. So what he did was he got a ping-pong ball and painted an eye on it, and he used that.
Ugh,
said Mary Ellen softly. So, I wouldn't go blowing out your ear holes anymore. She considered again.
Yeah, maybe you're right,
she said at length, and blew out her ear holes. In our few private moments, when Mary Ellen went off to tinkle in distant shrubs, Katz and I had formed a secret pact that we would hike 14 miles on the morrow to a place called Dick's Creek Gap, where there was a highway to the town of Hiawassee, 11 miles to the north. We would hike to the gap if it killed us, and then try to hitchhike into Hiawassee for dinner and a night in a motel. Plan B was that we would kill Mary Ellen and take her Pop-Tarts. And so the next day we hiked, really hiked, startling Mary Ellen with our thrusting strides. There was a motel in Hiawassee, clean sheets, shower, color TV, and a reputed choice of restaurants. We needed no more incentive than that to perk our step. Katz flagged in the first hour, and I felt tired, too, by afternoon, but we pushed determinedly on. Mary Ellen fell farther and farther off the pace, until she was behind even Katz. It was a kind of miracle in the hills. At about 4 o'clock, tired and overheated, and streaked about the face with rivulets of gritty sweat, I stepped from the woods onto the broad shoulder of U.S. Highway 76, an asphalt river through the woods, pleased to note that the road was wide and reasonably important-looking. A half-mile down the road there was a clearing in the trees and a drive, a hint of civilization, before the road curved away invitingly. Several cars passed as I stood there. Katz tumbled from the woods a few minutes later, looking wild of hair and eye, and I hustled him across the road against his voluble protests that he needed to sit down immediately. I wanted to try to get a lift before Mary Ellen came along and screwed things up. I couldn't think how she might, but I knew she would. "Have you seen her?" I asked anxiously. "Miles back, sitting on a rock with her boots off, rubbing her feet. She looked real tired. Good." Katz sagged onto his pack, grubby and spent, and I stood beside him on the shoulder with my thumb out, trying to project an image of wholesomeness and respectability, making private irked tutting noises at every car and pickup that passed. I had not hitchhiked in 25 years, and it was a vaguely humbling experience. Cars shot past very fast, unbelievably fast to us who now resided in Footworld, and gave us scarcely a glance. A very few approached more slowly, always occupied by elderly people, little white heads just above the window line, who stared at us without sympathy or expression, as they would at a field of cows. It seemed unlikely that anyone would stop for us. I wouldn't have stopped for us. "We're never going to get picked up," Katz announced despondently after cars had forsaken us for 15 minutes. He was right, of course, but it always exasperated me how easily he gave up on things. "Can't you try to be a little more positive?" I said. "Okay. I'm positive we're never going to get picked up. I mean, look at us." He smelled his armpits with disgust. "Jesus, I smell like Jeffrey Dahmer's refrigerator." There is a phenomenon called trail magic, known and spoken of with reverence by everyone who hikes the trail, which holds that often when things look darkest, some little piece of serendipity comes along to put you back on a heavenly plane. Ours was a baby blue Pontiac Trans Am, which flew past, then screeched to a stop on the shoulder 100 yards or so down the road in a cloud of gravelly dust. It was so far beyond where we stood that we didn't think it could be possibly for us, but then it jerked into reverse and came at us, half on the shoulder and half off, moving very fast and a little wildly. I stood transfixed. The day before, we had been told by a pair of seasoned hikers that sometimes in the South drivers will swerve at AT hitchhikers or run over their packs for purposes of hilarity, and I suppose this was one of those moments. I was about to fly for cover, and even Katz was halfway to his feet when it stopped just before us, with a rock and another cloud of dust, and a youthful female head popped out the passenger side window. "You boys want a ride?" she called. "Yes, ma'am, we sure do," we said, putting on our best behavior. We hastened to the car with our packs and bowed down at the window to find a very handsome, very happy, very drunk young couple who didn't look to be more than 18 or 19 years old. The woman was carefully topping up 2 plastic cups from a 3/4 empty bottle of Wild Turkey. "Hi," she said. "Hop in." We hesitated. The car was packed nearly solid with stuff, suitcases, boxes, assorted black plastic bags, hanger loads of clothes. It was a small car to begin with, and there was barely room for them.
"Darren, why'd you make some room for these gentlemen?" the young woman ordered, and then added for us, "This year's Darren."
Darren got out, grinned a hello, opened the trunk and stared blankly at it while the perception slowly spread through his brain that it was also packed solid. He was so drunk that I thought for a moment he might fall asleep on his feet, but he snapped to and found some rope and quite deftly tied our packs on the roof. Then, ignoring the vigorous advice and instructions of his partner, he tossed stuff around in the back until he had somehow created a small cavity into which Katz and I climbed, puffing out apologies and expressions of the sincerest gratitude. Her name was Donna, and they were on their way to some desperate-sounding community, Turkey Balls Falls or Coon Slick or someplace, another 50 miles up the road, but they were pleased to drop us in Hiawassee, if they didn't kill us all first. Darren drove at 127 miles an hour with one finger on the wheel, his head bouncing to the rhythm of some internal song, while Donna twirled in her seat to talk to us. She was stunningly pretty, entrancingly pretty.
"Y'all have to excuse us. We're celebrating."
She held up her plastic cup as if in toast.
"What are you celebrating?" asked Katz.
"We're getting married tomorrow," she announced proudly.
"No kiddin'," said Katz. "Congratulations."
"Yep. Darren, ye's gonna make an honest woman out of me."
She tousled his hair, then impulsively lunged over and gave the side of his head a kiss, which became lingering, then probing, then, frankly, lascivious, and concluded, as a kind of bonus, by shooting her hand into a surprising place, or at least so we surmised, because Darren abruptly banged his head on the ceiling and took us on a brief but exciting detour into a lane of oncoming traffic. Then she turned to us with a dreamy, unabashed leer, as if to say, "Who's next?" It looked, we reflected later, as if Darren might have his hands full, though we additionally concluded that it would probably be worth it.
"Hey, have a drink,"
she offered suddenly, seizing the bottle round the neck and looking for spare cups on the floor.
"Oh, no thanks," Kat said, but looked tempted.
"Go on,"
she encouraged. Kat held up a palm.
"I'm reformed."
"You are? Well, good for you. Have a drink, then."
"No, really."
"How about you?"
she said to me. "Oh, no thanks." I couldn't have freed my pinned arms even if I had wanted a drink. They dangled before me like tyrannosaur limbs.
"You're not reformed, are you?"
"Well, kind of." I had decided, for purposes of solidarity, to forswear alcohol for the duration. She looked at us.
"You guys like Mormons or something?"
No, just hikers. She nodded thoughtfully, satisfied with that, and had a drink. Then she made Darren jump again. They dropped us at Mull's Motel in Hiawassee, an old-fashioned, nondescript, patently non-chain establishment on a bend in the road near the center of town. We thanked them profusely, went through a little song and dance of trying to give them gas money, which they stoutly refused, and watched as Darren returned to the busy road as if fired from a rocket launcher. I believe I saw him bang his head again as they disappeared over a small rise. And then we were alone with our packs in an empty motel parking lot in a dusty, forgotten, queer-looking little town in northern Georgia. The word that clings to every hiker's thoughts in North Georgia is deliverance. The 1970 novel by James Dickey that was made into a Hollywood movie. It concerns, as you may recall, four middle-aged men from Atlanta who go on a weekend canoeing trip down the fictional Cahoolawasee River, but based on the real nearby Chattooga, and find themselves severely out of their element. "Every family I've ever met up here has at least one relative in the penitentiary," a character in the book remarks forebodingly as they drive up. "Some of them are in for making liquor or running it, but most of them are in for murder. They don't think a whole lot about killing people up here." And so, of course, it proves, as our urban foursome find themselves variously buggered, murdered, and hunted by a brace of demented backwoodsmen. Early in the book, Dickey has his characters stop for directions in some sleepy and hookwormy and ugly town, which, for all I know, could have been Hiawassee. What is certainly true is that the book was set in this part of the state, and the movie was filmed in the area. The famous banjo-plucking albino who played dueling banjos in the movie still apparently lives in Clayton, just down the road. Dickey's book, as you might expect, attracted heated criticism in the state when it was published. One observer called it the most demeaning characterization of Southern Highlanders in modern literature, which, if anything, was an understatement. But, in fact, it must be said that people had been appalled by Northern Georgians for 150 years. One 19th-century chronicler described the region's inhabitants as tall, thin, cadaverous-looking animals, as melancholy and lazy as boiled codfish. And others freely employed words like depraved, rude, uncivilized, and backward to describe the reclusive, underbred folk of Georgia's deep, dark woods and desperate townships. Dickey, who himself was a Georgian and knew the area well, swore that his book was a faithful description. Perhaps it was the lingering influence of the book, perhaps simply the time of day, or maybe nothing more than the unaccustomedness of being in a town, but Hiawassee did feel palpably weird and unsettling, the kind of place where it wouldn't altogether surprise you to find your gasoline being pumped by a cyclops. We went into the motel reception area, which was more like a small, untidy living room than a place of business, and found an aged woman with lively white hair and a bright cotton dress sitting on a sofa by the door. She looked happy to see us. "Hi," I said. "We're looking for a room." The woman grinned and nodded. "Actually, two rooms, if you've got them." The woman grinned and nodded again. I waited for her to get up, but she didn't move. "For tonight," I said encouragingly. "Do you have rooms?" Her grin became a kind of beam, and she grasped my hand and held on tight. Her fingers felt cold and bony. She just looked at me intently and eagerly, as if she thought, hoped, that I would throw a stick for her to fetch. "Tell her we come from reality land," Katz whispered in my ear. At that moment a door swung open, and a gray-haired woman swept in, wiping her hands on an apron. "Oh, ain't no good talking to her," she said in a friendly manner. "She don't know nothing, don't say nothing. Mother, let go of the man's hand." Her mother beamed at her. "Mother, let go of the man's hand." My hand was released, and we booked into two rooms. We went off with our keys and agreed to meet in half an hour. My room was basic and battered. There were cigarette burns on every possible surface, including the toilet seat and door lintels, and the walls and ceiling were covered in big stains that suggested a strange fight to the death involving lots of hot coffee. But it was heaven to me. I called Katz, for the novelty of using a telephone, and learned that his room was even worse. We were very happy. We showered, put on such clean clothes as we could muster, and eagerly repaired to a popular nearby bistro called the Georgia Mountain Restaurant. The parking lot was crowded with pickup trucks, and inside it was busy with meaty people in baseball caps. I had a feeling that if I'd said, "Phone call for you, Bubba," every man in the room would have risen. I won't say the Georgia Mountain had food I would travel for, even within Hiawassee, but it was certainly reasonably priced. For $5.50 each, we got meat and three, a trip to the salad bar, and dessert. I ordered fried chicken, black-eyed peas, roast potatoes, and rutabagas, as the menu had it. I had never had them before, and can't say I will again. We ate noisily and with gusto, and ordered many refills of iced tea. Dessert was, of course, the highlight. Everyone on the trail dreams of something, usually sweet and gooey, and my sustaining vision had been an outsized slab of pie. It had occupied my thoughts for days. And when the waitress came to take our order, I asked her, with beseeching eyes and a hand on her forearm, to bring me the largest piece she could slice without losing her job. She brought me a vast, vicious, canary-yellow wedge of lemon pie. It was a monument to food technology. Yellow enough to give you a headache, sweet enough to make your eyeballs roll up into your head. Everything, in short, you could want in a pie, so long as taste and quality didn't enter into your requirements. I was just plunging into it when Katz broke a long silence by saying, with a strange kind of nervousness, "You know what I keep doing? I keep looking up to see if Mary Ellen's coming through the door." I paused, a forkful of shimmering goo halfway to my mouth, and noticed with passing disbelief that his dessert plate was already empty. "You're not going to tell me you miss her, Stephen," I said dryly, and pushed the food home.
"No,"
he responded tartly, not taking this as a joke at all. He took on a frustrated look from trying to find words to express his complex emotions.
"We did kind of ditch her, you know," he finally blurted.
I considered the charge. "Actually, we didn't kind of ditch her. We ditched her." I wasn't with him at all on this. "So?"
"Well, I just feel kind of bad, just kind of bad, that we left her out in the woods on her own."
Then he crossed his arms as if to say,
"There, I've said it."
I put my fork down and considered the point. "She came into the woods on her own," I said. "We're not actually responsible for her, you know. I mean, it's not as if we signed a contract to look after her." Even as I said these things, I realized with a kind of horrible, seeping awareness that he was right. We had ditched her, left her to the bears and wolves and chortling mountain men. I had been so completely preoccupied with my own savage lust for food and a real bed that I had not paused to consider what our abrupt departure would mean for her, a night alone among the whispering trees, swaddled in darkness, listening with involuntary keenness for the telltale crack of branch or stick under a heavy foot or paw. It wasn't something I would wish on anyone. My gaze fell on my pie, and I realized I didn't want it any longer. "Maybe she'll have found somebody else to camp with," I suggested lamely, and pushed the pie away.
"Did you see anybody today?"
He was right. We had seen hardly a soul.
"She's probably still walking right now,"
Kat said with a hint of sudden heat,
"wondering where the hell we got to, scared out of her chubby little wits."
"Oh, don't," I half pleaded, and distractedly pushed the pie a half inch farther away. He nodded an emphatic, busy, righteous little nod, and looked at me with a strange, glowing, accusatory expression that said,
"And if she dies, let it be on your conscience."
And he was right. I was the ringleader here. This was my fault. Then he leaned closer and said in a completely different tone of voice,
"If you're not going to eat that pie, can I have it?"
In the morning we breakfasted at Hardee's across the street and paid for a taxi to take us back to the trail. We didn't speak about Mary Ellen or much of anything else. Returning to the trail after a night's comforts in a town always left us disinclined to talk. We were greeted with an immediate steep climb and walked slowly, almost gingerly. I always felt terrible on the trail the first day after a break. Katz, on the other hand, just always felt terrible. Whatever restorative effects a town visit offered always vanished with astounding swiftness on the trail. Within 2 minutes, it was as if we had never been away. Actually worse, because on a normal day, I would not be laboring up a steep hill with a greasy, leaden Hardee's breakfast threatening at every moment to come up for air. We had been walking for about half an hour when another hiker, a fit-looking middle-aged guy, came along from the other direction. We asked him if he had seen a girl named Mary Ellen in a red jacket with a kind of loud voice. He made an expression of possible recognition and said, "Does she..." I'm not being rude here or anything, but does she do this a lot? And he pinched his nose and made a series of horrible honking noises. We nodded vigorously. "Yeah, I stayed with her and two other guys in Plum Orchard Gap shelter last night." He gave us a dubious sideways look. "She a friend of yours?" "Oh, no," we said, disavowing her entirely, as any sensible person would. "She just sort of latched on to us for a couple of days." He nodded in understanding, then grinned. "She's a piece of work, isn't she?" We grinned, too. "Was it bad?" I said. He made a look that showed genuine pain, then, abruptly, as if putting two and two together, said, "So you must be the guy she was talking about."
"Really?" Kat said. "What did she say?"
"Oh, nothing," he said, but he was suppressing a small smile in that way that makes you say,
"What?"
"Nothing. It was nothing," but he was smiling.
"What?"
He wavered. "Oh, all right. She said you guys were a couple of overweight wimps who didn't know the first thing about hiking and that she was tired of carrying you."
"She said that?"
Kat said, scandalized. "Actually, I think she called you pussies."
"She called us pussies?" Kat said. "Now I will kill her."
"Well, I don't suppose you'll have any trouble finding people to hold her down for you," the man said absently, scanning the sky, and added, "Supposed to snow." I made a crestfallen noise. This was the last thing we wanted. "Really? Bad?" He nodded. 6 to 8 inches. More on the higher elevations." He lifted his eyebrows stoically, agreeing with my dismayed expression. Snow wasn't just discouraging. It was dangerous. He let the prospect hang there for a moment, then said, "Well, better keep moving." I nodded in understanding, for that was what we did in these hills. I watched him go, then turned to Katz, who was shaking his head.
"Imagine her saying that after all we did for her," he said, then noticed me staring at him, and said in a kind of squirmy way, "What?"
And then more squirmily,
"What?"
"Don't you ever, ever spoil a piece of pie for me again. Do you understand?" He winced.
"Yeah, all right, jeez,"
he said, and trudged on, muttering. 2 days later, we heard that Mary Ellen had dropped out with blisters after trying to do 35 miles in 2 days. Big mistake. Chapter 6. Distance changes utterly when you take the world on foot. A mile becomes a long way, 2 miles literally considerable, 10 miles whopping, 50 miles at the very limits of conception. The world, you realize, is enormous in a way that only you and a small community of fellow hikers know. Planetary scale is your little secret. Life takes on a neat simplicity, too. Time ceases to have any meaning. When it is dark, you go to bed, and when it is light again, you get up, and everything in between is just in between. It's quite wonderful, really. You have no engagements, commitments, obligations, or duties. No special ambitions, and only the smallest, least complicated of wants. You exist in a tranquil tedium, serenely beyond the reach of exasperation, far removed from the seats of strife, as the early explorer and botanist William Bartram put it. All that is required of you is a willingness to trudge. There is no point in hurrying, because you are not actually going anywhere. However far or long you plod, you are always in the same place, in the woods. It's where you were yesterday, where you will be tomorrow. The woods is one boundless singularity. Every bend in the path presents a prospect indistinguishable from every other. Every glimpse into the trees, the same tangled mess. For all you know, your route could describe a very large, pointless circle. In a way, it would hardly matter. At times you become almost certain that you slabbed this hillside 3 days ago, crossed this stream yesterday, clambered over this fallen tree at least twice today already. But most of the time you don't think, no point. Instead, you exist in a kind of mobile zen mode, your brain like a balloon tethered with string, accompanying, but not actually part of the body below. Walking for hours and miles becomes as automatic, as unremarkable as breathing. At the end of the day, you don't think, "Hey, I did 16 miles today," any more than you think, "Hey, I took 8,000 breaths today." It's just what you do. And so we walked, hour upon hour, over roller coaster hills, along knife-edge ridges and over grassy balds, through deathless ranks of oak, ash, chinkapin, and pine. The skies grew sullen and the air chillier, but it wasn't until the third day that the snow came. It began in the morning as thinly scattered flecks, hardly noticeable. But then the wind rose, then rose again, until it was blowing with an end-of-the-world fury that seemed to have even the trees in a panic, and with it came snow, great flying masses of it. By midday, we found ourselves plodding in a stinging, cold, hard-blowing storm. Soon after, we came to a narrow ledge of path along a wall of rock called Big Butt Mountain. Even in ideal circumstances, the path around Big Butt would have required delicacy and care. It was like a window ledge on a skyscraper, no more than 14 or 16 inches wide, and crumbling in places, with a sharp drop on one side of perhaps 80 feet, and long, looming stretches of vertical granite on the other. Once or twice I nudged foot-sized rocks over the side and watched with faint horror as they crashed and tumbled to improbably remote resting places. The trail was cobbled with rocks and threaded with wandering tree roots against which we constantly stubbed and stumbled, and veneered everywhere with polished ice under a thin layer of powdery snow. At exasperatingly frequent intervals, the path was broken by steep, thickly bouldered streams, frozen solid and ribbed with blue ice, which could only be negotiated in a crab-like crouch. And all the time, as we crept along on this absurdly narrow, dangerous perch, we were half-blinded by flying snow and jostled by gusts of wind which roared through the dancing trees and shook us by our packs. This wasn't a blizzard, it was a tempest. We proceeded with painstaking deliberativeness, placing each foot solidly before lifting the one behind. Even so, twice cats made horrified, heartfelt comic book noises, "Aye!" and "Urgh!" as his footing went. And I turned to find him hugging a tree, feet skating, his expression bug-eyed and fearful. It was deeply unnerving. It took us over 2 hours to cover 6/10 of a mile of trail. By the time we reached solid ground at a place called Bear Pen Gap, the snow was 4 or 5 inches deep and accumulating fast. The whole world was white, filled with dime-sized snowflakes that fell at a slant before being caught by the wind and hurled in a variety of directions. We couldn't see more than 15 or 20 feet ahead, often not even that. The trail crossed a logging road, then led straight up Albert Mountain, a bouldered summit 5,250 feet above sea level, where the winds were so wild and angry that they hit the mountain with an actual wallop sound and forced us to shout to hear each other. We started up and hastily retreated. Hiking packs leave you with no recognizable center of gravity at the best of times. Here we were, literally being blown over. Confounded, we stood at the bottom of the summit and looked at each other. This was really quite grave. We were caught between a mountain we couldn't climb and a ledge we had no intention of trying to renegotiate. Our only apparent option was to pitch our tents, if we could in this wind, crawl in, and hope for the best. I don't wish to reach for melodrama, but people have died in less trying circumstances. I dumped my pack and searched through it for my trail map. Appalachian trail maps are so monumentally useless that I had long since given up using them. They vary somewhat, but most are on an abysmal scale of 1 to 100,000, which ludicrously compresses every kilometer of real world into a mere centimeter of map. Imagine a square kilometer of physical landscape and all that it might contain, logging roads, streams, a mountain top or two, perhaps a fire tower, a knob or grassy bald, the wandering AT, and maybe a pair of important side trails. And imagine trying to convey all that information on an area the size of the nail on your little finger. That's an AT map. Actually, it's far, far worse than that, because AT maps, for reasons that bewilder me beyond speculation, provide less detail than even their meager scale allows. For any 10 miles of trail, the maps will name and identify perhaps only 3 of the dozen or more peaks you cross. Valleys, lakes, gaps, creeks, and other important, possibly vital, topographical features are routinely left unnamed. Forest Service roads are often not included, and if included, they're inconsistently identified. Even side trails are frequently left off. There are no coordinates, no way of directing rescuers to a particular place, no pointers to towns just off the map's edge. These are, in short, seriously inadequate maps. In normal circumstances, this is merely irksome. Now, in a blizzard, it seemed closer to negligence. I dragged the map from the pack and fought the wind to look at it. It showed the trail as a red line. Nearby was a heavy, wandering black line, which I presumed to be the Forest Service road we stood beside, though there was no actual telling. According to the map, the road, if a road is what it was, started in the middle of nowhere and finished half a dozen miles later equally in the middle of nowhere, which clearly made no sense, indeed, wasn't even possible. You can't start a road in the middle of forest. Earth-moving equipment can't spontaneously appear among the trees. Anyway, even if you could build a road that didn't go anywhere, why would you? There was, obviously, something deeply and infuriatingly wrong with this map. "Cost me $11," I said to Katz a little wildly, shaking the map at him and then crumpling it into an approximately flat shape and jabbing it into my pocket. "So, what are we going to do?" he said. I sighed, unsure, then yanked the map out and examined it again. I looked from it to the logging road and back. "Well, it looks as if this logging road curves around the mountain and comes back near the trail on the other side. If it does, and we can find it, then there's a shelter we can get to. If we can't get through, I don't know. I guess we take the road back downhill to lower ground and see if we can find a place out of the wind to camp." I shrugged a little helplessly. "I don't know. What do you think?" Katz was looking at the sky, watching the flying snow. "Well, I think," he said thoughtfully, "that I'd like to have a long hot soak in a jacuzzi, a big steak dinner with a baked potato and lots of sour cream, and I mean lots of sour cream, and then sex with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders on a tiger skin rug in front of a roaring fire in one of those big stone fireplaces like you get in a lodge at a ski resort. You know the kind I mean?" He looked at me. I nodded. "That's what I'd like, but I'm willing to try your plan if you think it'll be more fun." He flicked snow from his brow. "Besides, it would be a shame to waste all this delightful snow." He issued a single, bitter guffaw and returned to the hysterical snow. I hoisted my pack and followed. We plodded up the road, bent steeply, buffeted by winds. Where it settled, the snow was wet and heavy and getting deep enough that soon it would be impassable and we would have to take shelter whether we wanted to or not. There was no place to pitch a tent here, I noted uneasily, only steep wooded slope going up on one side and down on the other. For quite a distance, far longer than it seemed it ought to, the road stayed straight. Even if, farther on, it did curve back near the trail, there was no certainty, or even perhaps much likelihood, that we would spot it. In these trees and this snow, you could be 10 feet from the trail and not see it. It would be madness to leave the logging road and try to find it. Then again, it was probably madness to be following a logging road to higher ground in a blizzard. Gradually, and then more decidedly, the trail began to hook around behind the mountain. After about an hour of dragging sluggishly through ever-deepening snow, we came to a high, windy, level spot where the trail, or at least a trail, emerged down the back of Albert Mountain and continued on into level woods. I regarded my map with bewildered exasperation. It didn't give any indication of this whatever, but Cat spotted a white blaze 20 yards into the woods, and we whooped with joy. We had refound the AT. A shelter was only a few hundred yards farther on. It looked as if we would live to hike another day. The snow was nearly knee-deep now, and we were tired, but we all but pranced through it, and Cats whooped again when we reached a narrowed sign on a low limb that pointed down a side trail and said, "Big Spring Shelter." The shelter, a simple wooden affair, open on one side, stood in a snowy glade, a little winter wonderland, 150 yards or so off the main trail. Even from a distance we could see that the open side faced into the wind, and that the drifting snow was nearly up to the lip of the sleeping platform. Still, if nothing else, it offered at least a sense of refuge. We crossed the clearing, heaved our packs onto the platform, and in the same instant discovered that there were two people there already, a man and a boy of about 14. They were Jim and Heath, father and son, from Chattanooga, and they were cheerful, friendly, and not remotely daunted by the weather. They had come hiking for the weekend, they told us. I hadn't even realized it was a weekend, and knew the weather was likely to be bad, though not perhaps quite this bad, and so were well prepared. Jim had brought a big, clear plastic sheet, of the sort decorators use to cover floors, and was trying to rig it across the open front of the shelter. Cats, uncharacteristically, leapt to his assistance. The plastic sheet didn't quite reach, but we found that with one of our ground claws lashed alongside it, we could cover the entire front. The wind walloped ferociously against the plastic, and from time to time tore part of it loose, where it fluttered and snapped, with a retort like gunshot, until one of us leaped up and fought it back into place. The whole shelter was, in any case, incredibly leaky of air. The plank walls and floors were full of cracks through which icy wind and occasional blasts of snow shot, but we were infinitely snugger than we would have been outside. So we made a little home of it for ourselves, spread out our sleeping pads and bags, put on all the extra clothes we could find, and fixed dinner from a reclining position. Darkness fell quickly and heavily, which made the wildness outside seem even more severe. Jim and Heath had some chocolate cake, which they shared with us, a treat beyond heaven. And then the four of us settled down to a long, cold night on hard wood, listening to a banshee wind and the tossing of angry branches. When I awoke, all was stillness, the sort of stillness that makes you sit up and take your bearings. The plastic sheet before me was peeled back a foot or so, and weak light filled the space beyond. Snow was over the top of the platform, and lying an inch deep over the foot of my sleeping bag. I shooed it off with a toss of my legs. Jim and Heath were already stirring to life. Cat slumbered heavily on, an arm flung over his forehead, his mouth a great open hole. It was not quite 6. I decided to go out to reconnoiter and see how stranded we might be. I hesitated at the platform's edge, then jumped out into the drift. It came up over my waist and made my eyes fly open where it slipped under my clothes and found bare skin, and pushed through it into the clearing, where it was slightly, but only slightly, shallower. Even in sheltered areas, under an umbrella of conifers, the snow was nearly knee-deep and tedious to churn through. But everywhere it was stunning. Every tree wore a thick cloak of white, every stump and boulder a jaunty, snowy cap. And there was that perfect, immense stillness that you get nowhere else but in a big woods after a heavy snowfall. Here and there clumps of snow fell from the branches, but otherwise there was no sound or movement. I followed the side trail up and under heavily bowed limbs to where it rejoined the AT. The AT was a plumped blanket of snow, round and bluish, in a long, dim tunnel of overbent rhododendrons. It looked deep and hard going. I walked a few yards as a test. It was deep and hard going. When I returned to the shelter, Katz was up, moving slowly and going through his morning groans, and Jim was studying his maps, which were vastly better than mine. I crouched beside him, and he made room to let me look with him. It was 6.1 miles to Wallace Gap and a paved road, old U.S. 64. A mile down the road from there was Rainbow Springs Campground, a private campsite with showers and a store. I didn't know how hard it would be to walk 7 miles through deep snow, and had no confidence that the campground would be open this early in the year. Still, it was obvious this snow wasn't going to melt for days, and we would have to make a move sometime. It might as well be now, when at least it was pretty calm. Who knew when another storm might blow in and really strand us? Jim had decided that he and Heath would accompany us for the first couple of hours, then turn off on a side trail called Long Branch, which descended steeply through a ravine for 2.3 miles and emerged near a parking lot where they had left their car. He had hiked the Long Branch Trail many times and knew what to expect. Even so, I didn't like the sound of it, and asked him hesitantly if he thought it was a good idea to go off on a little-used side trail into goodness knows what conditions, where no one would come across him and his son if they got into trouble. Katz, to my relief, agreed with me.
"At least there's always other people on the AT," he said. "You don't know what might happen to you on a side trail."
Jim considered the matter, and said they would turn back if it looked bad. Katz and I treated ourselves to 2 cups of coffee, for warmth, and Jim and Heath shared with us some of their oatmeal, which made Katz intensely happy. Then we all set off together. It was cold and hard going. The tunnels of bowed rhododendrons, which often ran on for great distances, were exceedingly pretty, but when our packs brushed against them, they dumped volumes of snow onto our heads and down the backs of our necks. The 3 adults took it in turns to walk in front, because the lead person always received the heaviest dumping, as well as having all the hard work of dibbing holes in the snow. The Long Branch Trail, when we reached it, descended steeply through bowed pines, too steeply, it seemed to me, to come back up if the trail proved impassable, and it looked as if it might. Katz and I urged Jim and Heath to reconsider, but Jim said it was all downhill and well marked, and he was sure it would be all right.
"Hey, you know what day it is?"
said Jim suddenly, and, seeing our blank faces, supplied the answer.
"March 21st.
Our faces stayed blank.
"First day of spring," he said.
We smiled at the pathetic irony of it, shook hands all around, wished each other luck, and parted. Katz and I walked for 3 hours more, silently and slowly, through the cold, white forest, taking it in turns to break snow. At about 1 o'clock we came at last to Old 64, a lonesome, superannuated 2-lane road through the mountains. It hadn't been cleared, and there were no tire tracks through it. It was starting to snow again, steadily, prettily. We set off down the road for the campground, and had walked about 1/4 mile when from behind there was the crunching sound of a motorized vehicle proceeding cautiously through snow. We turned to see a big Jeep-type car rolling up beside us. The driver's window hummed down. It was Jim and Heath. They had come to let us know they had made it, and to make sure we had likewise.
"Thought you might like a lift to the campground," Jim said.
We climbed gratefully in, filling their nice car with snow, and rode down to the campground. Jim told us that they had passed it on the way up and it looked open, but that they would take us to Franklin, the nearest town, if it wasn't. They had heard a weather forecast. More snow was expected over the next couple of days. They dropped us at the campground. It was open, and departed with waves. Rainbow Springs was a small private campground with several small overnight cottages, a shower block, and a couple of other indeterminate buildings scattered around a big, level, open area clearly intended for camper vans and recreational vehicles. By the entrance, in an old white house, was the office, which was really a general store. We went in and found that every hiker for 20 miles was already there, several of them sitting around a wood stove eating chili or ice cream and looking rosy-cheeked and warm and clean. 3 or 4 of them we knew already. The campground was run by Buddy and Jensen Crossman, who seemed friendly and welcoming. If nothing else, it was probably not often that business was this good in March. I inquired about a cabin. Jensen stubbed out a cigarette and laughed at my naivete, which caused her a small coughing attack. "Honey, the cabins went 2 days ago. There's two places left in the bunkhouse. After that, people are going to have to sleep on floors." Bunkhouse is not a word I particularly want to hear at my age, but we had no choice. We signed in, were given two very small, stiff towels for the shower, and trudged off across the grounds to see what we got for our $11 apiece. The answer was very little. The bunkhouse was basic and awesomely unlovely. It was dominated by 12 narrow wood bunks, stacked in tiers of three, each with a thin bare mattress and a grubby bare pillow, lumpily filled with shreds of styrofoam. In one corner stood a pot-bellied stove, hissing softly, surrounded by a semicircle of limp boots and draped with wet woolen socks, which steamed foully. A small wooden table and a pair of broken-down easy chairs, both sprouting stuffing, completed the furnishings. Everywhere there was stuff. Tents, clothes, backpacks, rain covers, hanging out to dry, dripping sluggishly. The floor was bare concrete, the walls uninsulated plywood. It was singularly uninviting, like camping in a garage. "Welcome to the Stalag," said a man with an ironic smile and an English accent. His name was Peter Fleming, and he was a lecturer at a college in New Brunswick who had come south for a week's hiking, but, like everyone else, had been driven in by the snow. He introduced us around. Each person greeted us with a friendly but desultory nod, and indicated which were the spare bunks, one on the top level, nearly up at the ceiling, the other on the bottom, on the opposite side of the room. "Red Cross parcels come on the last Friday of the month, and there'll be a meeting of the escape committee at 1900 hours this evening. I think that's about all you need to know. And don't order the Philly cheesesteak sandwich unless you want to puke all night," said a wan but heartfelt voice from a shadowy bunk in the corner. "That's Tex," Fleming explained. We nodded. Kat selected a top bunk and set about the long challenge of trying to get into it. I turned to my own bunk and examined it with a kind of appalled fascination. If the mattress stains were anything to go by, a previous user had not so much suffered from incontinence as rejoiced in it. He had evidently included the pillow in his celebrations. I lifted it and sniffed it, then wished I hadn't. I spread out my sleeping bag, draped some socks over the stove, hung up a few things to dry, then sat on the edge of the bed and passed a pleasant half hour with the others, watching Katz's dogged struggle to the summit, which mostly involved deep grunts, swimming legs, and invitations to all onlookers and well-wishers to go fuck themselves. From where I sat, all I could see was his expansive butt and homeless lower limbs. His posture brought to mind a shipwreck victim clinging to a square of floating wreckage on rough seas, or possibly someone who had been lifted unexpectedly into the sky on top of a weather balloon he was preparing to hoist. In any case, someone holding on for dear life in dangerous circumstances. I grabbed my pillow and climbed up alongside him to ask why he didn't just take the bottom bunk. His face was wild and flushed. I'm not even sure he recognized me at that moment.
"Because heat rises, buddy," he said. "And when I get up here, if I fucking ever do, I'm going to be toast."
I nodded. There was seldom any point in trying to reason with Katz when he was puffed out and fixated, and used the opportunity to switch pillows on him. Eventually, when it became unsustainably pathetic to watch, three of us pushed him home. He flopped heavily, and with an alarming crack of wood, which panicked the poor quiet man in the bunk underneath, and announced he had no intention of leaving this spot until the snows had melted and spring had come to the mountains. Then he turned his back and went to sleep. I trudged through the snow to the shower block for the pleasure of dancing through ice water, then went to the general store and hung out by the stove with half a dozen others. There was nothing else to do. I ate two bowls of chili, the house specialty, and listened to the general conversation. This mostly involved Buddy and Jensen bitching about the previous day's customers, but it was nice to hear some voices other than Katz's.
"You should have seen him," Jensen said with distaste, picking a fleck of tobacco off her tongue.
Didn't say please, didn't say thank you, not like you guys. You guys are a breath of fresh air in comparison, believe me. And they made a complete pig pen of the bunkhouse, didn't they, Buddy?
She passed the baton to Buddy.
Took me an hour to clean it this morning, he said grimly, which surprised me because the bunkhouse didn't look as if it had been cleaned this century.
There were puddles all over the floor, and somebody, I don't know who, left a filthy old flannel shirt, which was just disgusting. And they burned all the firewood. 3 days' worth of firewood I took down there yesterday, and they burned every stick of it.
We were real glad to see him go, said Jensen. Real glad. Not like you guys. You guys are a breath of fresh air, believe me.
Then she went off to answer a ringing phone.
I was sitting next to one of the 3 kids from Rutgers, whom we had been running into off and on since the second day. They had a cabin now, but had been in the bunkhouse the night before. He leaned over and in a whisper said,
"She said the same thing yesterday about the people the day before. She'll be saying the same thing tomorrow about us. Do you know there were 15 of us in the bunkhouse last night?"
15?
I repeated in a tone of wonder. It was intolerable enough with 12.
Where on earth did the extra 3 sleep?
On the floor, and they were still charged $11 for it.
How's your chili?
I looked at it as if I hadn't thought about it, as in fact I hadn't.
Pretty terrible, actually, he nodded. Wait till you've been eating it for 2 days.
When I left to walk back to the bunkhouse, it was still snowing, but peacefully. Katz was awake and up on one elbow, smoking a bummed cigarette and asking people to pass things up to him—scissors, a bandana, matches—as the need arose, and to take them away again as he finished with them. 3 people stood at the window watching the snow. The talk was all of the weather. There was no telling when we would get out of here. It was impossible not to feel trapped. We spent a wretched night in our bunks, faintly lit by the dancing glow of the stove, which the timid man, unable or reluctant to sleep, with the restless mass of cats bowing the slats just above his head, diligently kept stoked, and wrapped in a breathy, communal symphony of nighttime noises. Sighs, weary exhalations, dredging snores, a steady dying moan from the man who had eaten the Philly cheesesteak sandwich, the monotone hiss of the stove, like the soundtrack of an old movie. We woke, stiff and unrested, to a gloomy dawn of falling snow, and the dispiriting prospect of a long, long day, with nothing to do but hang out at the camp store, or lie on a bunk bed reading old Reader's Digest, which filled a small shelf by the door. Then word came that an industrious youth named Zack from one of the cabins had somehow gotten to Franklin and rented a minivan and was offering to take anyone to town for $5. There was a virtual stampede. To the dismay and disgust of Buddy and Jensen, practically everyone paid up and left. 14 of us packed into the minivan and started on the long descent to Franklin in a snowless valley far below. And so we had a little holiday in Franklin, which was small, dull, and cautiously unattractive, but mostly dull. The sort of place where you find yourself, for want of anything better to do, strolling out to the lumberyard to watch guys on forklifts shunting wood about. There wasn't a thing in the way of diversions, nowhere to buy a book or even a magazine that didn't involve speedboats, customized cars, or guns and ammo. The town was full of hikers like us who had been driven down from the hills and had nothing to do but hang out listlessly in the diner or laundrette and 2 or 3 times a day make a pilgrimage to the far end of Main Street to stare forlornly at the distant, snow-draped, patently impassable peaks. The outlook was not good. There were rumors of 7-foot drifts in the Smokies. It could be days before the trail was passable again. I was plunged into a restless funk by this, heightened by the realization that Katz was verily in heaven at the prospect of several days idling in a town, on vacation from purpose and exertion, trying out various attitudes of repose. To my intense vexation, he had even bought a TV guide to plan his viewing more effectively over the coming days. I wanted to get back on the trail, to knock off miles. It was what we did. Besides, I was bored to a point somewhat beyond being bored out of my mind.
I was reading restaurant placemats, then turning them over to see if there was anything on the back. At the lumberyard, I talked to workmen through the fence. Late on the third afternoon, I stood in a Burger King and studied, with absorption, the photographs of the manager and his executive crew, reflecting on the curious fact that people who go into hamburger management always look as if their mother slept with Goofy